They didn't take the time to find out what the client wanted. They pushed their own agenda. I have seen house plans done for people that in the end were nothing like what the client wanted. So this is part of the success of finding a good designer. Now, obviously, they need to be accredited. They need to be have integrity and all of those things. If they're not asking you a bunch of questions and they come to you with a proposal and you've spent little time telling them what you want, you do not have a good designer.
Welcome to Friends of Build Magazine. I'm your host, Ted Bainbridge. I've been traveling the world and working in publications for 30 years. In 2016, we launched our first issue of Build Magazine, a publication dedicated to high-end home construction, renovation, and the innovative experts that make this possible. This podcast was created to have some fun and explore those who have taken on the challenge of building luxury homes in demanding locations. From navigating logistics and construction to excavating the earth, we want to learn more about these people and how their projects became cover worthy. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. This is such a treat. I've got Tricia Isabey with Furnish, Designs by Isabey, which you've got so many different entities.
I know. It's confusing.
Anyway, Tricia has, I heard about Tricia for years through Rhonda Barsley, who's our partner up in Canada. And then I met Tricia at a golf function up in Canada. And you're just such an awesome lady. This is our first quasi-remote because it's tough for Canadians to come down to the States and it's tough for me to get up to Canada. So we're going to kind of run with this. So Tricia, thanks for being here. Thanks for being the remote guinea pig, so to speak.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited to talk to you. And I've always admired you because of your, when you take an idea, when you see an idea, when you see an opportunity, you just seem to run with it. And to a degree, which I think is a great entrepreneurial spirit, you've got an idea and you're going to figure it out along the way because there is no path when you're an entrepreneur because that's where the opportunity is.
True. Very true.
So you started out from what I know, as a stockbroker.
Mm-hmm.
Did that for 15 or 16 years. Then you got pregnant, sold your book of business, took the most important job, which is being a mom. That's job one.
Hard job. Yep.
And there is no textbook on that one either.
No, there should be though.
There should be. Yeah, there should be.
Yeah, there should be. There should be some golden principles that we should all abide by. But I did. That was a hard job.
Yes. And then you got your kids to a stage where they were somewhat self-sufficient. I know they're still at home, so they're not completely hands-off.
My son was three. He was fine.
He was three?
Yeah, when I went back to work.
Okay, so what's the first entity that you started? And then you also need to explain about your relationship with Kevin, who I think is just fantastic. And he's more than just a golfer, but we'll kind of explain a little bit more about that. How did you start your first entity, and where did you come up with the idea that you wanted to get into interior design?
I feel like I did not come up with that idea. It happened very organically to me. I had a friend of mine who was a commercial developer, who I think was actually trying to get me to become a leasing agent for him, and threw me the bone of designing his commercial show suite, thinking that I would get interested in his business and eventually would come and sell for him. And I ended up falling in love with the whole process of designing that suite. I did not get paid well for it, which is fine, my first job, but it was a huge education for me. And after that, I could not want to do what that whole job entailed. So it kind of came about naturally. And then I just kept working after that.
So you started this, and it's funny because everything we get into and we fall in love with, we don't make any money initially. And then the money becomes a sideshow regardless. Yeah. I'm a firm believer that if you do something well, the money will look after itself. You don't work for money.
Yeah. No.
Money just comes.
Yep. No, and it wasn't about that to me. Having been in the brokerage business, I had been in an industry that there was a lot of money in, and I loved some of the job, but I wasn't passionate about what I did. And when I got into this industry, I was very much reintroduced to my creative side, which had become a very back burner kind of part of my life because I just didn't have time. I was busy building the brokerage business and then running it, and then I had children. And your creativity, I think, is what spurs a lot of your passion. So this is a very passionate endeavor for me.
So how do you become an incredibly successful broker without passion? And then second part of that question is, what did you learn from being successful when you didn't have passion to what's it like to work when you do have passion?
So to start off with, I wouldn't throw myself into an incredibly successful broker mode. I did well. I was 15 years in. I met all my targets starting out. I think that industry is extremely difficult. They hire a lot of people. And I don't know what the actual stats are, but judging from my rookie class, I think a third of them survive. I was driven by a couple things back then. I needed to make money. I was young. I didn't have anything to fall back on. So I worked my butt off. So number one, I think you can succeed in a lot of businesses without passion, but you maybe don't in, it doesn't drive you and you don't enjoy it. So I'm a very hard worker. I have no problem putting my effort and my sweat equity into a business or a job, which I did. I really loved aspects of the job. And then I am very, very, very good at spotting things I don't like to do. And so I very quickly built my team. I had an assistant early. I committed financially to an assistant. And then I took on a partner many years later. And I did the piece that I was good at, which was the marketing. I love the marketing. Again, that's creative. That was the first sort of, that was me really trying to move into that creative realm. And I liked dealing with clients. I enjoy dealing with clients. I hated doing the portfolio management side of it, which is kind of a big deal when you're a stockbroker.
Right. Yeah,
so
kind of a big deal.
It was a bit of a warning sign that I might not be in the right industry. However, when I left, I had a very solid understanding of finances and financial planning, and they taught me very well how to build a business. It was incredible training.
So are you detail-oriented? Or are you more visionary?
I'm visionary. Not at all. Yeah. Yeah. Details are not my thing.
So tell me about your core values.
My core values, personally, are kindness and respect. I don't believe in getting things in a way that hurts somebody. And I can't morally do that, even if it's good for me. It's not morally what I would do. I think, you know, I have my own set of sandbox rules, meaning, you know, business is business sometimes. And you're going after a client. Not everybody can get the client. In that respect, I think once you've entered the business forum, you're in the same playground as me. And you'll take my clients if they come to you. That sort of thing I think happens in the business world. However, I think you can do anything with kindness and respect. I think you can say anything with kindness and respect. So that is my core values. But what I try to do is always think about what's in it for the other person. So in a negotiation, I always become that other person. I take myself out of it. I mean, it's easy for me to figure out what's in it for me. But I try to put myself in the shoes of the other person and say, okay, now I'm them. This is my ask. Why would I do that? And if I can't answer that question, it's not the right deal.
So you built an incredible team at Isabey Interiors.
Yeah.
And now you're a general contractor.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty bold statement right there. Mm-hmm. What do you demand of your team, and how do you inspire your team to have the same core values that you do, so that you're all flying together?
Yeah, we have a different structure here. We are. I'm not the type of leader that is an island unto myself. I don't make all the decisions on my own. We're very collaborative in our decisions. Honesty is huge. I'm okay if you've made a mistake. Everybody in the team knows that. I make mistakes all the time. You just have to come to me when you have, so that we can problem solve the mistakes together. So I expect that. I expect that you are putting your all into what we're doing and that you're passionate about it. I do not accept negativity. They all know that. There's not very much. I would say that there's not many things that upset me more than when someone's been unkind to somebody on the team. So if there's some kind of weird drama playing out, I am the very first you're going to be in my office. We have a discussion. We don't put up with drama. I don't want to be that person. It's not how I operate. And I don't like negativity. If you're negative, you're not on my bus. My bus is a positive, high-flying bus. I'm okay with people coming to me and giving me feedback and saying, you know, this is how I feel about things and they think we could do this better. And I'm all for that. But I am very much about, if you're coming to me with some issue, you better be coming to me with some ideas, because I'm not here. I'm not the Wizard of Oz. I can't solve all the problems. I need you to be part of this team. You are hired for talent and intelligence. And if you are hired on my team, you are not there to complain about what's gone wrong or what you don't like. You're there to help us to get better, because we're not perfect. We're not going to be perfect. So the goal is to get better. So I expect accountability and I expect participation. That's most important.
I mean, it's okay to disagree. In fact, it's healthy to disagree.
Yes.
But don't whine. Come up with a solution. Yeah. If you don't agree with something, give an idea on this is how we improve it, or this is a better way of approaching it, and then we'll decide whether it does make sense or not.
Well, and it's very easy to look on the outside at an organization and to criticize it. It's another thing entirely to build one from scratch. You know, when I look at companies, my husband and I own another company, which we bought. It had all of the things in place that a company needed to run. It had been around for a long time. You may not like all those things, but if you have all those things in place, you can pick at the ones that you want to change. It's different when you start up a company where you don't even have a policy on who buys the toilet paper. Like, you have no policies. Like, it literally is, every single day is 7,000 decisions. Some of them are going to be right and some of them aren't going to be. And you got to get better at them over the years, you know, bit by bit.
So what do you learn from Kevin, who's your husband, and he's got a very successful boat company? And how many employees do they have?
500.
So what do you learn from, obviously there's a structure and a culture with his business. What do you learn from that and bring to your company, which was an idea, and now you've got, what, 30 employees?
Yeah. It's so interesting. I always say when we're having coffee in the morning in bed, like, who gets, like, there's not often times that you have two CEOs sitting there from different industries, different complete companies that get to collaborate on how we do things. So he's much more of an underpinnings guy. He is, it is a sales organization. They sell boats and Sea-Doos and all of those things. But Kevin would be, he runs the boating division, and he would be the one who is more so involved in the financials, in all of the operating things that are underneath the sales side. Not that he's not good at sales, but if I were to say what his personality is, it's much more that way. I'm the other way. I am much more sales, much more high-flying visionary level. My underpinning side is weak. I don't enjoy it. I don't know how to do it. So I rely on my team for that. So what we get to do is we get to collaborate on how he's done things versus how we're doing them, and vice versa. The two of us kind of go back and forth. But I have learned a lot about incentive plans. We are very different in our thinking on how we incent our employees. I'm not afraid to take a team that wants to make big money, because that's really what I'm all about. Is I'm not here to make, you know, 20 grand a year. I'm not interested in that. Nobody on my staff is interested in that. So I give them a lot of opportunity to make more money through sales. And that's his organization as well. So yeah, it is. The crossover is not so strong in terms of how I do things, especially as it pertains to my furniture and design store. But I would say on my commission salespeople, very similar.
So when you're sitting there having coffee with Kevin, and it's got to be an interesting conversation because you're not working together.
No.
And
a little bit. There is a little crossover.
Okay, explain that.
He has started to help us out on the home side. He's kind of a behind the scenes guy, but as my capacity, we expanded so much in the last 2.5 years that my bandwidth is a little bit stretched. So I took him on as a help for our home team. So what he helps us do there is he helps us coordinate contract issues. He advises on financials, that sort of thing. But he knows, and this is the fun part about being married, as you and your wife work together, so you understand this. I'm always like, I'm wearing the CEO hat. Don't tell me what to do. So we stay married.
Does he help you with process? Because if you're not detail-oriented, which is my biggest fall down, is I've got great ideas, but don't get me to write a manual, which everybody says, hey, Ted, you need to write a manual.
No. I did the best thing ever, and I will say it wasn't even something that I knew I needed. February 7th of last year, Kevin and I spent our very first anniversary together because we've been married for now 16 years coming up. But he was always at boat shows over our anniversary. So boat show, because of COVID, got canceled this year. So it was our first anniversary together. So we went and did a night away. And in the morning, we wrote our goals. And I wrote down that I wanted I wanted to have a manager of my overall company. And I wanted it to be somebody like my manager I had in the brokerage industry, who was a huge, huge, he was a huge influence on me. And I wrote that down, and not more than 2 weeks later, one of my staff came in and said, I have somebody you need to hire. And I was like, I'm not really hiring anybody. I don't know who you think I want to hire. And I said, well, I'll meet with her.
Your staff had no idea that this is what you were looking for?
No, no one knew
mentally?
That. No. And so this girl, I phone this girl that day. Her name is Kendra. And I have a conversation with her. And she was the operations manager at a kitchen cabinetry company. I have a talk. She comes in. I really like her. I am very much an intuit. I will follow what my gut tells me to do 99% of the time. And my gut was saying, you need this girl. And I still have no idea what she's going to do. And I said to her, let me think on this and I'm going to get back to you in the morning. And what I often do, because if I'm being guided by my intuition, which is a big, big part of how this business has grown, is I let myself be quiet and I don't try to figure it out. And if I give myself a little bit of time, usually it's overnight, in the morning, it comes to me what I'm supposed to do and I keep following that path. So in the morning I wake up and I'm like, this is my person. This is the person I asked for. And it's come very quickly. And I have to make a decision right now. If I want to grow properly, I'm going to have to spend the money on this person to get her working for me. And I just, as classic Tricia form, jumped in and said, I'm going to hire you. I'm going to meet what you need. And I want to get you started. So she joined me as my operations manager. And it has been night and day having her on the team. We have really made a lot of strides in our processes because she actually does them. Like, she is on it. So I've been very fortunate to have somebody who actually enjoys processes. I feel like we aren't there yet, but we're certainly on our way.
Going back to Kevin and your conversations and the fact that he's got a 500 employee company, which is a monster employee or monster company.
Yes. Yeah.
And I know that when I first met you, I said, what does your husband do? And you said, well, he's just a golf pro. And then I meet him and he is one sharp dude who ended up, you bought a boat company that was then merged with a John Deere dealership in Alberta, which hence that's why you've got all these employees.
Yeah.
In the process, I look at companies like that only from the standpoint of our company, which we have about 20 people. You've got a few more. And then I look at those major companies, and to your point, people will come to you and ask you questions and you go, well, I haven't really thought about that. And yet big companies, they have all that stuff. Just go to the manual.
Yeah.
It's all laid out.
Everything is hard at a startup.
Yes. Yes. And I mentioned to you that we hired a coaching company, CEO Coaching, and I was on a call with our coach today, and this guy is from the tech world. He was, and I'm going to guess that Lou is probably 60. He's probably my age. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm talking to him, he goes, I've built 3 companies and sold them. And he was from the video conferencing world. And one of his companies, 2 of his employees started Zoom, to give you kind of an idea. And those companies, all 3 of them, one of them was $100 million, one was $500 million, and the other one, in today's dollars, he sold for $2 billion.
Jeez.
So but he's all about process. And I go, how do you get excited about a small company like ours? Mm-hmm. He goes, Ted, I get excited about people. Mm-hmm. The product is part of the equation, but it doesn't matter the dollar signs.
No.
He goes, if I can get excited about something, mm-hmm. then I will run with it. And he goes, money means nothing to me. So you're going to pay, but it's not like it changes my life, because it doesn't. He goes, mm-hmm. I just want to be in the game and I want to use my brain. And he goes, I am a teacher at Loyola in LA, and I'm a teacher at another school, which he can do. He lives in Palm Beach. He can do it from there. And he goes, I take the money that they pay me to teach. He goes, I work for $1 a year. The rest of my salary goes towards funding new entrepreneurs, because I want to encourage them to continue. You know, down here we call it the American dream. I just think we're so fortunate. I was born in Canada, obviously. I moved down here. I think we're so lucky to live in North America, where if we see something, we can take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Yeah. But he's not wrong. I mean, he's not wrong about the processes. Like, I'm reading a book, which I'm sure you've read, and if you haven't, you need to pick up. It's Atomic Habits. And it talks about, you know, the process is how you're going to get there. You have to stop focusing so much on the goal, because as long as if you know what the goal is, then it's building the framework, that you're a daily framework to get to the goal, and you will get there. And stop worrying about how fast it's going to be, because you have no control over that. And that piece he is correct on.
Yeah, it is all about the process, which is my weeks. I mean, I understand the process when I'm out in front of people.
Yeah.
But like your husband, the back end process, that to me becomes a little bit boring.
Yeah. You need an operations manager. I'm telling you, it changes your entire world. Like, I never realized how important that structure was.
Yeah, we just had, I had a gal who's worked for us for 6 years, and she is, Rhonda loves her, Susan. She is all about staying on top of things, and she is super diligent at those things. And she said, Ted, I'm looking for another 20 hours a week. Is there something? And she's worked in sales, and she really is that detail-oriented person, where it's, that's, I'll put things together.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we said, to your point, okay, we don't have a job for it, but we know it's necessary, so we're going to hire you. Mm-hmm. And it kind of takes a lot of the burden off me. So when something comes up, I say, hey, Susan, can you look after this? And I know it'll be executed the way I want it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huge. But that's like, I mean, I think at the end of the day, when you have those people, they hold you accountable to making sure that you're, you know, as a visionary, it's very intimidating for other people. You know, they look at what's going on with me, like a lot of my staff, they're all terrified if I'm going to come up with another company, because then they have to build it, right? So
right.
It's important that we have underpinnings underneath us to make sure that we are not going too fast for our team.
So tell me about your different companies and lay them out, because I get a sense that it's like a Lego puzzle. And here's another thing I told I just kind of came up with this idea. It's like, have you ever seen the movie The Accountant?
No.
With Ben Affleck?
Mm-mm.
Oh, you have to. Write it down.
Okay.
You have to.
Okay.
It's a great movie. But he's an autistic kid, mm-hmm. who is incredible with numbers, like most autistic kids are. And one of the opening scenes is he puts together a puzzle, but the puzzle is upside down, and he's putting piece by piece together, and it's all blank. And then when you flip it over, it's a picture of Muhammad Ali.
Ooh, it's wild, eh? Mm-hmm.
And businesses are all about a puzzle, and you come up with an idea, but until you get enough of the pieces put together, it doesn't mean anything. And then all of a sudden you get enough pieces and it starts to take shape. And I'm always encouraging my team, hey, when we open these new markets, it's all about the pieces of the puzzle. And in the initial stages and in our world, once you hit 20 clients, you've got enough momentum, enough of the puzzle is put together. Whereas the early adapters, which is definitely what you are, you'll come on board because you can see the vision, whereas most people are more laggards when it comes to ideas. They want to be able to see most of the development done. They want to see the infrastructure for the development. They want to see that the clubhouse or the golf course or the tennis courts or the pool, whatever, so that they can go, oh yeah, this is real.
But the death of a detail person, Ted, is that they think too much about those details. They actually know how much work is going to go into it.
Okay.
What, the visionary doesn't even know what it's going to take. And we just do it thinking, this looks easy. We can do this. I can handle this. And when I get there, I'll get the pieces in place. I think there's a couple things that are really important when you're a visionary is I don't think you can be a perfectionist. I don't think that there are visionaries that are perfectionists because otherwise you'd wait for your vision to be perfect and it's never going to be perfect. Right. You would have a complete, I call it FTL, which is a failure to launch.
Yes.
If you are too detail oriented, if you have too much of a perfectionism side, you will never execute. And you're going to keep looking for all the answers and keep planning and planning and planning. And when you're 65 or 70, you're going to go, ooh, I probably should have done this. Yeah, you should have. I mean, I think at the end of the day for me, like my belief system is that we're here to do big things. You've got to be courageous enough to try it. Doesn't mean that you're going to succeed at it. Like every day I think, you know, I wake up lots of days where I'm like, oh crap, this is not going well today. These things like, you know, yesterday my Instagram got hacked. What happens with that? I have no idea how to deal with that.
Right.
There are so many of those that come up and yet how fun is the ride? Even though it's hard, how fun is the ride? I don't go to work and do a 9-to-5 job every day. I get every day is something different.
Okay, so I wasn't going to ask this question. I didn't even think about this question, but you kind of led my brain to this. And I want to go back in a second to the Lego, the building blocks, because you had Isabi Interiors, then you had Furnish. Now you've got your construction company, which I don't know the name of, but
Isabi
I can Isabi. Okay, so I can see the building blocks, but I want to go back to that failure to launch. What do you see with the younger generation because they're afraid of failure because nobody around them is allowed to say you failed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
that's just so true. Everybody gets an award. You get an award for being the last.
Yeah.
Everyone gets an award. I think that they're not just afraid to fail. I think that they are they come from almost a different mentality, and it's that critical side of tearing apart that which has already been done.
I just spent the last 2 days playing golf with 3 NHL hockey players. And we kind of talk about this because they're all, you know, they're 50 and 60 years old. One of them's in the Hall of Fame. And you talk about the mentality of playing hockey. And even in today's game, it's a softer game where people are afraid to hurt people's feelings. Guess what? We all get cut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, kids today don't know how to ask a girl out on a date. They just swipe right, which I don't know what that means. I just know the terminology. and so now all of a sudden you lose your nerve. You lose your ability to put yourself out on the failure's part of life.
Oh,
and
yeah,
failure, and we need to embrace
critical.
It.
It's critical to success. I don't think you can succeed without failing. You know, I listen to, and this is the answer to your question in a roundabout way. I do master classes. You can get that app and do master classes. And I listen to Howard Schultz from, he's the CEO of Starbucks.
Yep.
And I was about 2 classes in and he started the same way as me. You know, he started off with, I think the company he worked for was Xerox, and he was sent away for a 3-week training courses, which is exactly what I did. I started working for a brokerage company. They sent me away for 3 weeks. And technically, I started working out for a financial planning company first, which was even more interesting. But he came back and his job was to cold call, which is exactly how I did it. For 4 years, that's all I did was cold call. You know, every day you're dialing for dollars. Every day.
This is what Howard Schultz did?
Yep. Every day.
I didn't know that.
Dialing for dollars. And I can tell you the amount of times you are told to F off is astronomical. Your rejection factor is so high that you kind of just get used to that being part of the sales game. And I remember after being at, first of all, the financial planning firm, which was an incredibly hard way to make money, the way that clients had to sign up was brutal, brutal. Then I went to the brokerage firm. I still had the same process in terms of how I got clients, but they were really established, had a really good name. I thought it was easy, even though I was still cold calling, in comparison to what I did before, felt easy. Well, then you put me into an interior design company where I'm selling bricks and mortar. Like, I'm selling stuff you can touch and feel. We can prove this stuff. That felt even easier. So I think that the problem is when you start off in life and you have no challenges, you're given the corporate job right away, you get out of university, you've got a corner office, all of those things, and you never had to build anything yourself, you're never going to be good at handling those tough situations.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're not going to go into the book that you're going to write now on raising children, because that is a whole other podcast.
Definitely not writing that.
But so talk to me about so we've got Isabee Interiors, then the Furniture Store Furnish, then Homes by Isabee.
Yeah, Isabee Home, yeah.
Or Isabee Home.
Explain to me. And then we have Furnish for You too, so there are actually four companies.
Okay, so explain, I can see it visually in my head. Mm-hmm. But what's happening in all four of them? And then what are some of the trends that you're seeing? What are your clients asking for? Have you been on the track long enough to see changes in people's wants and needs and desires?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not that your clients have, you know, wants is, or needs is a ridiculous question with the clients that you have. It has nothing to do with needs. It's all about wants.
Mm-hmm. I think, so we started off with Isabee Interiors, and in 2019, I went from 5 employees to now 30. And the path that happened there was, as I brought more designers on, in our area, there was not a great solution for finding good home decor and furniture. There just wasn't a great solution. We're in a smaller area. We have some furniture stores, but it wasn't meeting the need. And I started off, when I started with Isabee Interiors, because I was a stockbroker by trade prior, I could not get my head around hourly fees. I mean, I can charge them. I don't understand them. I've never done it. I have only ever made commission. So I took on a number of furniture companies out of the gate. And I had no business taking on these furniture companies. I didn't have enough business. But I was a great dial-in for dollars. And I was phoning the biggies, like the big, big manufacturers, and selling my company and selling my my ability to sell to my clients. And so I amassed a very, very strong list of suppliers. So when my designer...
And what was your reaction when you picked up the phone? I'm assuming most of these guys are in High Point, North Carolina.
Yes, yes. Okay, I don't think they'd ever been called by a designer that way.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I'm pretty sure. I remember I was the first for one of the major companies out there, the very first design company that ever opened up. And I didn't take no for an answer. And I also didn't want the design account. I said to them, I am not a designer. I am going to sell furniture. Like, I'm not going to just handle one or two pieces a year. I'm going to sell a lot. So I got opened up as wholesale, which is what the bricks and mortar stores get. So that was a unique that happened. And some of the accounts that I got into were just wild. Some of them were some of the top furniture companies in the world. And I was entertained by some of the big furniture, the big names, Christopher Guy, the big people. It was crazy. So I when my designers came to me and said, we don't have a store that we can really go to that's working and we want to make money at it. Would you consider opening up a store? So timing wise, this would have been at the end of 2019. So of course, you know me, my jump both feet in, I'm absolutely, yep. Sounds easy to open a store. I decide, yeah, I'm going to open this little store in the same location that I'm in. We start the renovation. And then COVID hits. And I had just seen you actually. And yep. I was knee deep in this new endeavor.
I think we got COVID together.
We did COVID together, and I ended up, while the first 2 months that we were at home, because in British Columbia we weren't locked down very long, but we were locked down for a couple months, I just bought product for the store, and I launched my store the beginning of July 2020 in a really crazy location. Like, not, it is not in a normal shopping location. It's out more where a lot of the construction industry is, a lot of the flooring companies, countertop companies, and so on. So I'm in a weird location, but right below my studio. And it's a year and a half that we've had the store, and it has turned into a tremendous success, but we have really worked at it. And then we started in the fall.
So explain, sorry, only because we're friends and I know Kelowna so well. Where is the store? How big is the store?
You've been to my studio, correct?
No.
Oh, okay. So we're by the airport.
I haven't been there in 2 years.
Yeah,
Your
fair.
government won't let me go.
Yeah. We 2 year or sorry, we are right by the airport. So we're in
Okay.
more of an industrial section of Kelowna. My studio is well, or sorry, my store is well visual from the highway. So you do see from the highway the signage. But we're located in a hardwood floor store. We made a great partnership with one of the owners of Okanagan Hardwood, and well, both the owners of Okanagan Hardwood, and we were given a studio to work out of as an interior design studio, and then they came up with space for us for the furniture company. We are currently in the process of, we're about to build a big building for my company alone, which is very exciting. But that store was launched then. Then we launched our gift box company, Furnish For You, in the fall because I wanted to be able to address the needs of corporate gifting. Again, these are all needs I had. So I'm a big believer in, if I can't, I'm pretty resourceful in terms of finding what I need and want in any community. And if I can't find it, then to me, it's an opportunity, and it's an opportunity I can fill. So we started our gift box company, and the very first season, we did well over six figures on gift boxes, and we never advertised. So that was pretty crazy. And then in, sort of like end of the year, I hired again one more person based on intuition. I had hired my first construction person, but he was coming on more as almost in the design side. He does a lot of design work as well. And then I hired one more
Was this our
project
COVID
manager.
gifter, Travis?
Yes, this is Travis. So Travis was a great hire for me and great visionary, but definitely he had a foot in both worlds. He was design and he was construction. And then I hired Michelle Watson, and she also had a very similar situation to Travis. And when I introduced the two of them, Izzy B Home was born. Again, it came. It wasn't in my plan. It was something that we had very loosely talked about, and all of a sudden in January we had two builds we were starting on, and we have been flying ever since. And we are expanding. We'll add people to our. We're going to be adding some people to our company. It's been one of the hardest things I've ever done, because I will tell you, if opening a store was hard, opening a construction company was harder and more complicated. And I think because I didn't have the same background in construction as both Michelle and Travis, for me, it was intuitively understanding some of the pieces that were involved. So that's where we are. So now we sit with four. Our overall banner is moving to Isabee Collective, which Rhonda helped me kind of settle on.
Great name.
Yeah, so the Isabee Collective has got the four companies underneath it, and the whole puzzle, as you say, is because I felt coming from the brokerage industry into this industry, it was very fresh eyes. Having no background in that industry, I was able to see the strange dynamics between construction and design. And what I mean by that is a little bit of infighting, a little bit of like, who's in charge of this build? Like, who's the king? A little bit of that kind of hierarchy that went on. Not a lot of really great understanding on either side of how hard it is to do both of those jobs. And I felt like there needed to be some sort of marriage in the two industries. So our construction company is what we call collaborative design. We are collaborative contractors. We are not new home warranty providers. So in Canada, you have to have a new home warranty license to build a home. We work with new home warranty builders, but we literally partner on the construction job. So we handle a lot of the construction pieces. They handle other pieces.
Okay, so you're not
as a team.
So you're not a general contractor.
We are a collaborative contractor. So no, we are not. We are not at the point where we're doing. We can do renovations, but in Canada, to do a new home, you need a new home warranty, and we have not gone down that path as of yet.
Do you see that happening? It seems natural.
Maybe at some point. Right now, we need to nail what we're doing. And we're in service to the contractor. So everyone here, at least in our community, is flat out on builds. Like, you can't get a contractor to save your soul right now. It's very, very busy. Yeah. But what they can do with us and what they do with us is they can leverage their time, because they'll take the build up to drywall and we take over. So you can imagine if the most time-consuming part of that build is dealing with the client on the design side. It's very time-consuming, and it isn't necessarily every builder's passion. A lot of builders want just to build. They don't want to deal with the design side, so we have separated the process into two jobs.
So if you're dealing with the contractor, mm-hmm. who, do they love you or do they fear you?
No, they love us because we bring them work. So we're the bird dog for the work. We do a lot of marketing and we get a lot of clients that phone us. So we bring the work and we handle the part that most of them hate. So no, it's a lovely relationship. I think at first it was a little intimidating, but as we've worked through it, it's a service to them and it's a service to the client.
So in Kelowna, when people are building houses there, are they using architects? Are they using designers?
Mostly they don't use architects for homes here. The odd person will. It's a bit overkill. Most of them use a draftsman, somebody who can do construction drawings. So we have people on our staff that do that and do incredible work. But we also use other draftsmen in town. And if we need to, and the clients that really demand an architect or need an architect, like our commercial clients, we work with architects as well.
So even if you have a $10 million house on the water, people aren't going to use an architect?
Depending upon the size of the home, there are some qualifications you would have to get an architect on board. But the majority of the homes here, no.
Okay. Just in Oregon, when we built houses there, we've used designers, and here we used an architect. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the fees are different, but the size of the houses were, like, our place is 3,700 feet. It's not huge, but everybody uses an architect here.
Yeah. It's not like that here. And to be honest, for the most part, unless there's something extremely complicated, you don't need it. And that's not to say that, you know, architects aren't necessary. They're incredibly, incredibly gifted and talented. It's just that, you know, there are certain jobs that require more expertise than others. And I think too, what we bring to the table is the ability to help with how the design layout goes, because I think oftentimes we see a lot of plans that you can tell a designer wasn't a part of. So it's nice having someone on staff. It's a little bit more cohesive.
Okay. And it's probably fantastic for the client to be able to deal with one team.
Oh, it's the easy button.
Yeah. So where do you see your vision going with what you're doing? Can you see taking it to the Lower Mainland, down to Vancouver? Can you see going to Calgary, other markets?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we already are doing, we do jobs outside of Kelowna.
Okay.
Our client is a targeted client. I think our client is that luxury client that is looking for an expert to deal for them. Like, it's interesting. I often say to my team, if your clients already know what they're doing, they probably aren't clients for us. Like, if your clients know what they want completely, they've done their, they basically hand you a list of everything they want, that might not be our client. Our client needs our help. And we want to be in service to our client and help them to build the vision. They may have the vision, but they don't have the how-to. So we are definitely a certain type of client. We like dealing in homes that inspire us. So we're not really a cookie cutter kind of designer. I would say that there's definitely like plateaus you have to get to in terms of the size of job you're working on before we'll get involved. Because there's lots of people out there that do other types of builds, and we don't want to, that's not really the lane that we're in. So we're trying to stay in our lane. That seems to be That's the vision that I have for the team is, again, really know which client they're after and really stay in that lane and continue to bring about an ease of the process. Like, we are big believers in 3D. We do 3D for everything because I think it's very easy to misinterpret what we are doing from a design side if you can't see it. So we have some extremely talented people on staff that do 3D drawings and video walkthroughs for us. And it is the ability to, yes, we spend money on that area, but the process goes way faster. And the clients feel a lot more, they feel trust and they feel more comfortable in what you've proposed for them. So
do you see a TV show in your future? I mean, when you say about 3D, I'm thinking about either Love It or List It or the Property Brothers where they use it. And it really does allow people to crystallize easily. Mm-hmm. We're building our fourth house and we hired an interior designer and I had forgotten the value. All you look at initially is it's going to cost you a lot of money. I mean, you could hire an employee for what it cost you for the designer. And as soon as we got their design book, it was best money we could have spent.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's so similar to what you were talking about in your company, having that operations manager, having the underpinnings. That's what we do. We are the underpinnings of the house. So much money is spent on time wasted. Yeah. So like I always hear from my builders, they hate working with homes that don't have designers on them because they end up being the designer. They get the questions from the client. What do you think of this flooring? Where should I go for this? What should I do for that? How should I build it this way? And we just hand it to them. It's a design book. It's the Bible of your house.
Yep.
It's everything you need to know. It's which tile, how much of it, where is it going to go exactly to the, you know, minimal inch. This is where it goes. This is how it is laid out. Here's a picture. Here is a chart. Here's the video. Here is the written specifications. All of that is important. So I think that piece is critical to making a house successful.
I think for anybody that's building a house, $1.5 million, $2 million or more, it's the easiest check to write is to get a good designer because it makes the process more fun. Mm-hmm. It's visually, their design books are incredible. This gal we've got down here has done an amazing job. And it takes a lot of, like, there's a ton of decisions that go into building these places.
8 billion decisions. And one decision can change your entire design. So, you know, we've had a client, I remember one of my clients changed their mind on their hardwood floor. And they decided to go, we're going to do tile, the tile that they chose for their entryway. Well, that threw everything off because there was pattern in the tile. We had pattern in some marble on the wall. It's like starting from scratch. Like you can't make those decisions without understanding the complications that it's going to give for the rest of the process. So what I think it is it's like that operations manager. We become an emotional counselor. Because 9 times out of 10, you're on the roller coaster of the build, which is, you know, in this day and age, there is definitely a bigger challenge on getting product.
I don't know how long the build process is up there, but a lot of homes will go for two or three years.
Yeah.
And the average marriage in America, if somebody told me, was 3 to 3.5 years.
Yeah.
You're a marriage counselor.
Yeah, and the beauty of the team that we have, because we do really work as a team. If you're dealing with one of our designers, there's a very strong chance you're dealing with more than one. You're probably dealing with two or three. And because I think a lot of relationships, if as it goes past that year process, have relationship fatigue. You need a fresh voice in there sometimes just to make things a little bit, smooth things over or help the person out or give your team member a break during the process. So I like the team approach.
That's well said.
Well, hopefully.
Fatigue.
It is. It's relationship fatigue.
I think that's awesome.
And you end up being the front person. You can imagine you walk into a business and you meet the receptionist and the business is run really poorly and that person is your person. It may not be their fault, but they're the front person. So it's not their fault that the supply chain isn't working out. It's not their fault that, you know, the electrical contractor made an error over here, but they get the brunt of it. And it is a very hard role to play. And I've watched all of my people, and I'll tell you, my hat is off to them. It's one of the things that I'm here to do is to educate the general public and the construction industry in general as well about how hard this job is. Like that, like we get positioned as pillow fluffers. Like that, it could not be further from the truth. The amount of work and intelligence and expertise that comes from the design side, I mean, it is the success of your build. Like it doesn't matter how good your builder is. If your design sucked or wasn't properly planned, you're in trouble.
So what's the difference between a good designer and a bad designer? When you talk about pillar fluffers, and I've seen enough designers who over-accessorize and then it becomes clutter.
Yeah.
So how does the consumer go, well, this is a good designer or this isn't?
I think you have to, again, start looking at if you're going to go into how do you get start from the very beginning. You're going to look for the testimonials. You're going to look at the projects that are online. But when you're interviewed, this is how you know you have somebody who's not going to be a good fit for you. If they don't ask you 8 billion questions about what you want,
yep,
you do not have the right person. Like there is a massive amount of information gathering that needs to take place before you can do anything for somebody. We send out something called, again, so I took a lot of things from the brokerage industry. When I built my company, I built a brokerage industry for designers. One of the things we have to use in the brokerage industry is called a Know Your Client form. And it is all the things that risk tolerant, time horizon, education level, all of that. So I built a Know Your Client form for design that is 70 some odd questions long that
Hold
you're going to get
Trisha.
From us.
Trisha, that's process. How did you
it
do
is.
It?
I don't, well, that was, I pulled that from the brokerage industry. So I am, if nothing else, I don't reinvent the wheel. I look at somebody who's done it before me and I adapt. That's how I tend to make things work. I don't spend a whole, someone's done it somewhere. I'd rather take the time to find somebody who's done it to 80% of what I'm looking for and then I'll adapt it. So I ended up, the Know Your Client form is a questionnaire. So what I can tell you is I have been on jobs where the previous designer was fired. And I'll tell you what I've learned. I have learned why they were fired is because they didn't listen. They didn't take the time to find out what the client wanted. They pushed their own agenda. I have seen house plans done for people that in the end were nothing like what the client wanted. So this is part of the success of finding a good designer. Now, obviously, they need to be accredited. They need to be have integrity and all of those things. But if they're not asking you a bunch of questions and they come to you with a proposal and you've spent little time telling them what you want, you do not have a good designer.
True. True. Completely agree with you. Did you ever envision when you're a little 10-year-old girl that this is where you'd be? Dealing with clients that have some pretty cool projects that you get to, your sandbox is pretty good.
Yeah. No, I did not. In fact, I had, even as a teenager, after I graduated from school, my plan was to become a makeup artist.
Really?
Yep. I had very little, my original plan was I wanted to be a lawyer because apparently my dad told me I was a very good negotiator and I argued well.
Yes.
But I ended up...
You hang in there very well.
Yeah. Fairly tenacious. But I did not attend university. I got married out of high school and then divorced. But I was married young and I ended up getting involved in... right prior to getting married, I got a job with an eye surgical clinic. And I wrote their aptitude tests and I got pulled into the president's office. It was a big organization. They were top four in the world for their field. And she said to me, we have never met anybody with as high an aptitude score as yours. Would you be interested in us training you to be like an ophthalmologist? And I said, no. I said, I come in every day to this job. I am nauseous looking at the surgical screens. I hate the outfit I'm wearing. I'm wearing scrubs. I can't have makeup on. I am like so out of touch with reality here. This is not where I want to be. And she said, okay, tell me what you want to do. And I said, I want to be a makeup artist. And she looked at me and she goes, no. I said, what? She said, you may not be a makeup artist. She said, Trisha, she said, you have too much intelligence and too much talent to not go and do something, not dissing makeup artistry, but to not do something with yourself that is different and unique. You need to go do something really big. And I could have taken that and opened up a makeup industry or a makeup enterprise, I guess, because I did have a love of that. But her words stuck with me. And I went and worked for a bank. And that was when I started my whole process into the financial side. And, okay. You know, we are where we are today.
Well, you are a glamorous lady. There's no doubt about that.
Like me, my makeup.
To go to work for a bank from the makeup world is a confusing paradigm.
It is.
You mentioned you were divorced.
Yeah. But,
and you've been married to Kevin for 16 years, correct?
I have, yeah.
Okay. What'd you learn from your first relationship? How different is Kevin from your first husband?
Oh, night and day.
So you didn't fall into that pit where you're going to marry the same person twice.
Well, no.
Not the same person, but the same personality.
No, and of course, I've been married three times, so I managed to go through two relationships early. My learning at 20, you just don't know what you want, and you don't know who you are. So I can't even relate to the girl I was then. The girl I was when I met Kevin was, I had a very good understanding of, a much better understanding of who I was. I was a little bit more, I had more solid footing. I was more mature. I had been through a lot. I married my friend because Kevin and I were friends for 4 years before we actually got romantically involved. And it worked. I think we're equals, which I think is really important in a relationship, at least for someone like myself who I don't do well in hierarchy kind of situations. I want a seat at the table. You know, it doesn't matter what table it is. I want a seat at the table. I don't have to run the table, but I want a seat at the table.
So you're a very inspiring lady, and I've always been super impressed with you. And you know, because whenever we talk, which isn't often enough, but whenever we talk, I always take some sort of nugget away from the conversation. And I have an affinity for strong women, and I love the fact that you're in the construction industry, because I think that that is an industry that really needs a female factor, not just a bunch of guys swinging hammers.
Mm-hmm.
How do you mentor people, your team, and how do you inspire your kids and get the most out of them?
Well, I think for me, 4 years ago, my life changed trying to mentor my daughter. My daughter was, I wanted to teach her how to think positively. And I had years and years ago, read the book and watched the movie, The Secret. And I read a book that I don't think is in publication anymore called The Power of Losing Control. And so in my infinite, desire to inspire her, I pulled the movie up and we watched it, myself, my son, and my daughter. It was in January of, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago. And she kind of looked at me like I had three heads. But the person who got inspired again was me. And what I had done the 15 years prior to that is I had written a list, it's 14 years ago, almost 15 years ago that I wrote my very first list of all the things I was thankful for, all the things that I wanted, and I did a vision board. And I had done that when I was trying to get pregnant with Lauren, and the doctor had told me I was infertile. And I did this list. I had written in there all the things I wanted, and I had a vision board that had pictures of the children, like children, and I was pregnant in 2 weeks. So that really inspired me from previous. So I started this process again 4 years ago, wrote my list. And I'm telling you, Ted, I get up in the morning. First thing I do is I get a coffee. No news goes on. I read my whole list of things I'm grateful for. And it's big. I read my list of things that I want every day. Rhonda's seen me do it. I take it with me. I have it on my iPad in photos in case I've forgotten my
book.
That's
awesome.
This was the turning point in my life. This is when everything changed. If you think of the timing of the company, you know, 2019 is when things switched for me. But the process of the build, in terms of the build of the company, all started with this gratitude list and this morning routine. So I read the book, The 5 a.m. Club by Robin Sharma. So that
book, I have that.
Yeah, that was probably the most pivotal book for me. At the time when I started doing this morning routine again, I started that book and I just followed everything he said. I just was like, perfect. You tell me what to do and I'm going to do it. And so my morning routine, after I do my gratitude, my list of wants, I spend some time planning my day. And most days I try to do some exercise right away. That happens, you know, sometimes, but hopefully more times than not. And I start my day every day like a champion. Like I feel totally different after I've done that. I've included meditation at times. I've included the journaling, all the pieces that come from somebody who has a really solid core. So I take the time to do that every morning so that when I start out the day, I'm in that frame of mind. So when my Instagram gets hacked, as it did yesterday, I'm not all cortisol screaming, stressful. I'm in a space that says, okay, well, you know what? Bad stuff has happened before. I'm sure there's a workaround. I'm sure there's a way we can deal with it. Yep. So that was huge for me. And that's how I try to teach my team. And that's what I do with my kids. I talk to them about if you have a solid inner space, you'll have a solid outer space. You have to have that inside.
It's really hard to solve problems when you're frantic.
Yes. And you have to take care of yourself. Like I thank God I've always been a self-care person. And I recognize when I'm weak and when things are starting to go downhill. Right before Christmas break, I knew I was done. I had had way too much on my plate. I needed a break. And I took 3 weeks off. I said, I'm gone. I'm out. You're not going to see me. If you need me, it has to be something really important. But I took the time to re-energize and to reset. But with my daughter, it's all, what's that?
Are you ready to go?
Oh yeah, I came back. They're all like, oh no. She looks way too energetic.
With your daughter?
Yeah, so my daughter, with her, I've really watched some great things with my kids over the years. Just the change in what she wants out of life, how driven she can be now. And I think, you know, I was fortunate to have people who believed in me. Not everybody has that. That's what I want to be for my staff. I'm the person that believes in them.
Yeah. Yeah. And we need to teach them how to fish and not just give it to them.
Oh, 100%. Yes.
Yeah. And challenge them and yeah.
Yep. And make them do a little more than they think they're capable of.
Last question for you. What are you most proud of? You've accomplished so much.
I think I'm most proud of my relationships. I think that I put a large value on people. And because I care about people, the rest flows a little bit more naturally.
Well, I appreciate our friendship. You have made such an incredible difference in our partner, Rhonda, in Kelowna.
And vice versa.
Yeah, she looks to you as part of her rock. I won't say exclusively, but there's no question she admires what you do, and you've given her, I've just seen so much growth out of her and confidence, and I know a lot of that comes from you being her friend. So we've benefited.
Very mutual relationship and an incredible human.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a champ. That woman is relentless as well. And that's a great quality that all of us should have or aspire to have. Mm-hmm. So Tricia, thanks for getting through the technology of this virtual call today. I love what you do. I love your ambition. I love your tenacity. Everything about you, you're just a fabulous lady, and thanks for being part of Friends of Build Magazine.
Well, thank you for having
podcast.
Me, Ted, and it's all mutual. I really appreciate and admire Build. You guys are incredible partners for us. We've really come a long way since we've joined the Build community.
All of us.
And I look forward to lots of future good times together.
All right. Well, thank you. And until next time, I'm Ted Bainbridge, and we appreciate you listening. Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. You can find everything discussed in this episode and more in our show notes below. I'm Ted Bainbridge, and you've been listening to Friends of Build Magazine podcast.